Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 18 Summer Show. We are your hosts, Jim
and Jamie Shields. We're here to help you bring family back.
In the last decade, we've helped thousands of families create the family life that you have always wanted.
We give you simple solutions on how you can ignite your family life and succeed in both business and at home.
And please remember, time is of the essence. You only have 18 summers to truly connect with your children.
So let us help you make the most of it.
Hello, 18 Summers Tribe. We're here today with Letitia Fry. We're super excited that we have a mutual friend, Glenn Marsden, out of Australia, who connected us. And Letitia, welcome.
Hey, thanks, gang. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Now, Letitia Fry is known as America's foremost auctioneer. So what a fun combo between auctioneer and entertainer. She is a mother of two teens, almost not teen anymore, one of them, right? Residing in Arizona. She's raised over $500 million for charity over the last 16 years.
Wow.
Yeah, she must be pretty good at what she does, huh? She's the author of the critically acclaimed book, No Reserve, A Guide to Living a Limitless Life. Welcome. Thanks for being here. There's so many things that are wonderful and beautiful about you, and we'll get into those as we continue to talk, but welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad that due to technology, you could be in Costa Rica and I can be in Arizona and we can hang out.
That's perfect. Perfect.
I love it. Love it.
So I wanted to talk to you. One thing that you and I really connect over and that I felt inspired by as I watched you in this business for 16 years and really making not just an imprint as an auctioneer, but also, you know, you've been on live morning shows and your influence in fashion, just some of the things that you are so passionate about living and doing you while being a single mom. That's not an easy balance to do you and your children.
It's not. And you know what's interesting is that I divorced from my kids' dad when they were pretty young, about 2 and 3 years old, which is never easy for anyone. And we certainly absolutely loved each other, but he suffered from some addictions that just, you know, sometimes you have to make those difficult decisions. So around the time my kids were 2, 3, 4, you know, I'm on my own. And I'm, when I said on my own, I took no alimony, took no child support, anything like that. So you're on your own. So you call yourself a single mom. But lo and behold, at the ages of 11 and 12, that same father who would then turn into my best friend, but still struggling with his addictions, would take his life. Then you're like, single mom, you know? So it's an interesting question because you have these balances you put in place as a quote unquote single mom, but still at least able to defer to another parent, even though they're not really in the picture. And then suddenly they are 100% gone and you realize, no, you are really single mom now. It's really a lot to kind of digest that terminology because we do kind of throw that around and single mom could mean divorce. It could mean children out of wedlock. It could mean somebody passed. It's different for everybody, but for me, that balance became so important when the true idea of, whoa, I can't even call someone to say, well, do you, you know that sometimes you're like, can you just take the boy? Well, I'll take the girl and, you know, we'll just skip it a little. There just isn't anything. So that kind of started to have to come from me. And so it was really difficult, really difficult. And right before his death, I went through a near death and very horrifying accident that left me with a brain injury. So I'm already trying to figure out balance, trying to figure out how to survive. And then you're adding in the fact that I'm alone with these children. So what really came down to it was that, you know, faith and family first. I mean, that's really kind of how I roll. So if I don't have my faith, and by faith, believe me, I don't even mean necessarily book religion or anything like that. I mean, my internal faith of that relationship with my source from within that keeps me going. And then my family, it has to come first. And being someone that's not easily able to say no, that's a learned trait when you're not really raised around the environment to be allowed to say no to things. So when you're thrown from the idea of, well, I'm a single mom because I'm parenting alone predominantly to no, really, there's just one parent, that balance becomes imperative. And it really means it's learning to say no, checks and balances. And it also means just to remember constantly faith and family first. And the reason why I say faith first is because that's that mental check-in from within that keeps you in the sane zone so that you can put family first. You know, you got to have that internal check-in, especially after injuries, traumas, deaths. You really got to take that time of that meditative space, of that really sourcing space, and then put the children in. And then you have to realize paying bills is paying bills, but surviving is not living. And if you want to raise children and you want to raise good people, then you need to live, not just survive. And that requires balance within yourself and your children and your work. And that's an art form for sure. And one that you kind of have to recheck in and keep learning as they alter and move, as you know, from toddler to school age to tween to teen and to what will soon to be young adult for me. So yeah, it's an ever evolving process and it's always an honor, always an honor.
What is some of the most important lessons you think that your children have seen through your resiliency in this role? I always talk like, you know, when I meet another mom that is, you know, working really hard at doing the single mom thing, you know, whether it's, like you said, truly alone, you know, or if it's parenting with someone, you know, around the corner that also fills the bank account, you know, however it may be, if you're feeling singled out in some form or fashion, that's not an easy road. And those of us that have even been, like you said, no support, no other person, like nothing. It's the hardest job in the world. It is the hardest job in the world. And I have so much love and appreciation for moms that do that. But certainly there's some incredible things that your children have learned from you through watching this process.
You know, it's always really interesting when you want to see if your kids are taking things in. There's two ways that I always see. It's what they give you as a gift, because they tend to make them. My kids tend to make them for me, and there's so much of them self-expressed in that. And secondly, when you hear them do a report that you didn't know they were doing on you for school, you know? And so my kids, before my book was published, they knew that I wanted to publish a book. So they created a little book for me of all the things that they learned from me.
And they said, even if
no one ever publishes your book, this is what we learned from you. And it was all these things I had told them over the years. Like I used to say, you know, where are you most beautiful? And they would say, in my heart. And I would say, why? And they said, because we're kind and sweet to others. I would say things like, you know, what did you put on today? They say a smile. What'd you pack? Good attitude. What do you have the makings of? A great day. And so they put all these momisms in this book for me. But the last one in there, oh, I get choked up still to this day, was that failure is not a matter of getting knocked down or quitting. Failure is when you just simply give up. Like they pretty much defined it as, you've taught us, mom, that like, it doesn't mean winning isn't like necessarily having all this, but what truly failure is just not continuing to try. And so they really learned that you can be knocked down, but you don't have to be knocked out. And they found that the true element to how that is by giving to others. And so when I see them go out of their way to do things for people that I have nothing to do with, I mean, absolutely nothing. And they've been doing that for quite some time. You kind of sit there and you go, wow, it seeped in, you know, it seeped in and it's nice. And so, you know, as a teenage boy, my son is 17 and, you know, the athlete and, you know, Mr. Macho. And unfortunately, with the death of a father when he's 11, he kind of got thrown into man of the house very early on. And that's a double-edged sword. But he had to do a project for school, and in the COVID, they are home. So he didn't think I'd be home during this presentation he had to give. And so he was presenting it to his class, and it was on his hero, and it was on me. And it was essentially on how he learned that failure is just really when someone gives up. It's not a matter of whether or not you achieved something or you got where you needed to go. It's the fact that you never stop trying. And so it was really touching. So I think that in those moments when you can see it's getting in, is that when they take the time to make something that puts themselves in it, that says thank you, when you see their own actions that are kind and what you would hope to embody for another without you having anything to do with it. And then lastly, when they go to present something on what they could pick anyone, a sports hero, a, you know, whatever, and they pick you. So those are moments that are very, very humbling. And that's where that word honor comes in again. I always feel I struggled with a very dysfunctional parenting from my own upbringing. And I don't know how you are, but when you're younger, you know, you're like, I'll never do this. You know, I'll never say that we can't stop in the car to have a bathroom break before we get there, or these little things. But you know, having this lack of support that I grew up with, I really said I always wanted to give them a voice. I always wanted to allow them to be their own person without expressing necessarily all of myself on them. So when I say it's an honor, it's because I was kind of raised in this deal of like, you know, I'm your parent and you owe me, you know? So that's the way I was raised. You know, you'll do it because I said so. You're under my roof and you'll do it. And then you owe me after.
And so for me, that's not the way I have. I see that every moment of my parenting is an honor. It's really an honor. And it's my duty to step it up. I brought them in this world. They didn't choose it. I chose it. And as they evolve, they're looking to me to lead, which means I have to evolve. So I always see it as this tremendously humbling honor and a serious responsibility, and one that you can't just sit back upon in those laurels, even on those good moments. And so for me, I always say humbling honor, very, very humbling honor. And when you get those little rewards in it, it just makes you go, wow, what a gift, you know, what a gift to see conscious human beings that
it's
came from you.
Powerful mindset that you bring to it, obviously. And it's funny, the similarities I see between you and Jamie with overcoming things of our toughest things becoming some of our greatest triumphs. Yeah. And I can't tell you, Tish, how many times in interviews that we've recently done, how the word addiction has come up.
Yeah.
So much. And I just think there's this huge thing. If parents list two things that they're absolutely terrified of, one, not having a relationship with their children, two, addiction. And it's not even addiction for themselves, addiction for their children. And what has kind of been your steering grounds? And I'm sure we might have some common things around this. Well, again, we always try to steer towards sobriety, not away from addiction. And I just think it's a big subject right now.
But not abstinence.
Not abstinence. Right. No, yeah. Responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, Jamie and I have a glass of wine, but obviously we stay away from lots of things. And
of course,
that wasn't always family history, but addiction, concern of addiction for our children is a big thing. And it sounds like you've done a great job. So I just kind of wanted to get your take on that, because I know parents are going, oh my gosh, she overcame this. She did this. They seem like great kids. I follow her on Instagram. How have they avoided that dark path of addiction?
You know, it's so interesting. And you kind of touched on something. Okay. So first of all, they watched their father essentially lose their life. He took his life, and addiction was plagued within that. You know, I think that scared them a bit, but I've always had this honest, open platform that I used for them. Again, I think it comes from giving them a voice. So for me, when they were as little as just maybe 7 months old and a little over a year or 2 years, I started volunteering at camps for my clients. So I went to volunteer as a camp counselor at a camp for children with cancer. And then I started volunteering at a LGBTQ camp specializing in transgender youth under the age of 14. So when I was with these other kids, and at this point, my kids are 2, 3, kind of coming up. And so when I'm with these two groups, I mean, I'm really with kids that are in that teen area, and they're sharing with me. A lot of the times kids with cancer had parents that were incarcerated, addicted. And a lot of the kids that had been gay or trans, they were actually throwaways, not runaways. And so one of them said to me once, as we sit in this powwow at the beginning of camp, and I'm way older than any of the counselors, and they're like, you know, and you do your PGP, your preferred gender pronoun. And one of the trans kids said, so why are you here? And I said, I'm here so you can make me a better parent. That's why I'm here, because I'm going to hear things through you of what you have to say. They're going to allow me to communicate down the road, because I don't really have a healthy upbringing to look back upon. So I'm going to go down and dive into these kids that are already in the thick of this stuff. They've already attempted suicide. They've already been in that edge. And I want you to talk to me. So I learned so much from their voice that I brought it home. And I actually once contemplated writing a book called How to Be a Camp Counselor to Your Own Kids. Because when you're a camp counselor, these kids would come to me and gravitate to me and share this incredible knowledge. And I'll give you a prime example. One of my children was always in a book, always in a book. She just lived in a book. She's an illustrator. She's an artist, always had her head in a book. And one time I'm at this camp, and this kid explains why he's always in his book, and his mother never understood, because in his book, he can be gay. In his book, he can be who he is. So that's why he's always in his book. Well, I went home and asked, is this why? And she said, no, but thank you for coming at that with that approach. So I started to also apply addiction into this. You know, you kids are struggling through drinking and this, and what did you see? What should I know on communication? So one of the things I got very early on was a very non-judgment platform, but an open, honest way to talk. So we did roses and thorns early on. You know, what are your roses today? What are your thorns? But also, you know, let's be truthful. So if you wanted to cuss or say a word or whatever, let's just do it at the kitchen table. Let's just let it out, you know? Early on, I let the kids play. I'm just totally going to tell you the truth. I let the kids play Cards Against Humanity. Not, you know, they all think they know what they're talking about.
guilty.
Yeah, they think they know what they're talking about, and necrophilia came up. And I'm like, really, what do you think that is? And so they gave me all their definition, and they were like 12 or 13. And then I told them what it really was, and they were like, just sat there with their mouths open. That's kind of how I approached addiction, drugs, and the rest of it. What do you think it is? Now let's talk about what it is. So I also said, you really want to try something? Here, here's a beer, have it. They don't want to try it. So at this point, with a freshman in college, my daughter, who has struggled through depression, struggled through suicide, and is doing great. She's sort of the love child of Tim Burton and Quentin Tarantino. I mean, she just got that mind, you know, and that's why she's studying illustration and a full ride at a great art school. But she would tell me, she's like, I just don't have, I know that that lies within me. So she's chosen not to ever, she's just at this point, a completely sober child. And I'm kind of baffled by it, but I say, you know, okay, cool. But then I got a son who's a little bit more the athletic football type. And what I was up against and didn't anticipate was male masculine culture. So I was up against the fact that, hey, it's the guys who are going to have a beer. And I've got a kid with no father. So I've worked very hard with mentorship and other men. And the day his father died, he was just tears coming down when I finally got home and said, Mom, as strong as you are, how are you going to make me a man? Like, how are you? He was definitely, he was scared. He thought it required a man to make him a man. And I said, son, with help and through example, a man doesn't learn to be a man by a man. So now I have this boy that's turning 17 that I've been up against football culture, sports culture, the brother-in-law, you know, that I love to death, uncle that's over that's like, hey, I should be able to have a beer with him. They just, you know, did this and we just won the state championship. So I'm against that culture. So I really kind of had to find a way to say, okay, again, let's have this open discussion of what that means. So I kind of said, all right, you want to try it? Here, you know, like, for example, his team was going to go to Ireland. It's legal drinking age of 16 in Ireland. You know, I said, if you think you can sit down and drink a warm pint of Guinness and keep it down and show up to sports tomorrow, good for you. Yeah. So, you know, I kind of took this approach of let's not pretend like not my kid, you know, not my kid. Yeah. And let's not pretend like if it doesn't happen in my house, it's not going to happen outside of my house. But let's talk about it open and honestly, just like necrophilia. Do you know what it is? You know, right. Do you know what it means really when people overindulge? Do you understand what addiction can do? Like, you've seen it in your father. So to be honest with you, it's a working, open, ever evolving again thing that changes as those, again, tween to teen, to, you know, it just seems like every time you kind of get the hack of what you're doing, they change and you're like, oh, we're starting over. So now as we're running into young adulthood, I would say that my daughter's in a very much more grounded by choice place. My son is in a place of what makes him a man and cool and fits in, but still a very responsible kid who does not want to drink and drive, this and that. And I'll be honest, once in a while, he'll say at a family picnic, can I have a beer? Or if we're, you know, in Mexico, and I'll say, you know what, if you really want to do that, that's fine. But I'm just going to remind you, it's illegal if we're in these areas, it's legal over here. So just consciously use what you're doing and be smart about it. But I will say that, you know, culture and pressure, particularly within masculinity, kind of goes against that, you know? So yeah. To answer your question, it's always open, honest. It's always a safe environment at home. I'm not about to tell you, hey, have a bunch of friends. We're not doing that. So, and I'm also going to tell you, if you're going to take your car and you're going to go somewhere and you have your curfew, you ever, like, it's up to you. My camp counselor kids would tell you, I would say, I trust you until you give me a reason not. I am the coolest camp counselor in the world until you give me a reason not to. And I am your worst nightmare. On wheels.
That's so healthy the way that you, and we've tried to do the same thing, Tish, where I think you make something the forbidden fruit, it becomes the forbidden fruit. You know, totally. We're just so, it sounds like it's something so incredible. So we tried to take that same approach where it's very open, honest, conversational. And again, when you can observe things around, and we've had addiction all around our family, they can observe it for themselves and we talk about it. We don't not bring it up or anything like that. And again, like Jamie said, it's a responsibility thing, not a complete cut off of this because then forbidden fruit comes. And I love how you said, and I think this is one of the things that has been the absolute key thing, I think, that has helped us. Jamie and I have always said, it might be our kids. Like, that's just our honest thing. We're like, it might be our kids. And some of these people that go, my kids would never, ever do that. We go, yeah, my kids might do that. I remember being a teen and trying to sneak around doing something and, you know, not get in trouble. And so Jamie and I always had this thing where we're like, it might be our kids. And that thing, and you just kind of said that, and I think it doesn't disrespect the child. It gives vulnerability and honesty and lack of perfection to them, which is a great gift.
the other thing is that they're not like some sort of prize or property for me to roll around. Like it's my accomplishment to say my kid would never do that. That's ridiculous. I mean, come on, I would. You know, I mean, I'm not perfect. I mean, I've got a peppered past. Trust me. I mean, you know, their dad and I, you're not married to an addict just because you were goody two-shoes. You know, I mean, we met in college, of course, you know, try living in LA in the 80s. Sure. You know, so, but that's the other thing. I've left this open environment. When my kids turn to me and ask me, have you tried this, 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 and this? I've given honest answers. I've also given honest answers to what the ramifications of trying this, 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 and this were, and where I could have been versus where I was and what I learned in the process. Now, does that mean you're going to learn it from me? No, but I'm not going to lie to you, even if you might not want to hear what I'm going to say, you know? So I've kind of left that open environment.
Yeah, vulnerability is key. So good on you for showing the honesty and vulnerability, because it's not about perfection. That's what I've learned. And when we try to make ourselves look like we're perfect to our kids, they can't live up to it. They can't even relate to us if you go for that perfection mode. So we're pretty imperfect and comfortable.
Oh, flawed and good with that. Imperfectly perfect, as our friend Glenn would say.
Yeah, Glenn, yeah. We're back to Glenn.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now in your book, No Reserve and Living a Limitless Life, can you tell me a little bit about what you're sharing with others and how we can apply this down to our youth as parents?
Of course, 100%. So obviously being within the auction industry, I'm going to use a terminology that comes from my line of work. So no reserve means going into something absolute or all in. It means that you didn't say, well, I'll set the price at this to open up. It means that you told the world you're willing to take any offer and go for it. So oftentimes people's reserves in their life personally are, well, we'll get divorced when the kids are out of the house. You know, I'll quit my job when I have enough money in the bank. You know, like it's really just this telling the universe, I'm only going to go this far, and then wondering why no opportunity is showing up in front of you, you know? So it's this really kind of mindset of self-limiting beliefs. And so when you start to learn to, you know, I'm not telling people to go, you know, jump out of planes or whatever, unless that's what you want to do, but risk adverse, you'd be surprised that, you know, people find chasing their happiness risky. You know, they find getting out of an unhealthy relationship risky. They find getting into better health or stopping addictions risky. You know, it's really a sort of, you know, no one is standing in your way quite like you. And when you are willing to put that energy out there of like, I'll go this far, you know, then the universe goes, well, you can have this much, you know? So a lot of the practices I learned in there, again, came from all these years of volunteering. And a lot of it came around this youth that were in the depths. I mean, when you're at a camp for kids that have pretty much been ostracized from every part of the world, you know, I was camp counselor 10 years ago for gay and trans kids. That was, you know, a lot happened in 10 years, you know, and trying to figure out where you are within your faith, in your family, where, you know, where do you fit in? I learned so much about them because those are corners of the world that we all visit at times, you know? And so, you know, understanding from them, like, how do you get out of that space? So I learned something from them called SOS, which is a source of strength, which actually means save our souls. When, you know, people think it means save our ship, when we used to do that in Morse code, it means save our souls. And so, you know, for me, that's putting on running shoes and heading out the door, getting outside. It means certain music. It means cooking. It means my kids. It means my dogs, you know, sunshine. You know, I know what without a second's thought, if I just go do it, because when you're in a bad place or you're really down, you know, you can't be like, what are my sources of strength? No, it's just stuff you can just automatically cruise into. And why that's important is because, you know, when everyone has like that, it's New Year's, let's have that resolution, or you have that great uplifting podcast, you're like, I'm doing it. And then you run into the neighbor that's like, no, you won. You're like, you know, or whatever happens, and you just, it's just, you know, you being moved, and this is actually a quote in my book, being moved is not the same as taking action. It's not the same. So, you know, what are the things that can help you actually get that reserve down and keep it down? So giving is a huge part. So many times with people in their life, when they're trying to get beyond their fear, their limitation, they don't have a sense of worth. There's no self-worth. And I found by accident, I made it part of my business plan that when I would work for over 100 charities a year, I had to go volunteer for a day, whether it means going to Haiti. I'm leaving to go to Morocco here soon to actually go be with disabled girls that are learning on Project SOAR. So I go get on the ground with this and learn this. So after that accident and the deaths, and I had zero self-worth, I mean, brain injury, flailing, former husband kills himself, talk about low. And yet I have to show up to abused women and children with cancer. I have to go see an ALS patient. I have to do this as part of my job. And you're sitting there with them and then they suddenly look at you and they go, thank you. This was really great. And you're like, it's like the Grinch and your heart starts going and you're like, wait, thank me? You know, thank me, I had something to hear. And then you also look at them and realize, well, maybe I don't have it so bad because there is no cure for ALS and your child is sick. And, you know, so these meters, so giving is a huge way to get the limitation off your life. Mentorship is amazing. And so many people think you have to mentor once you've gotten somewhere. I mentored on the way. If I'm mentoring out of poverty and divorce with low money, making $20,000 a year with five jobs, moving up, why can't I be mentoring the girl at Circle K who's right there with me and the other woman that was a former drug runner turned, you know, sober? So I'm mentoring those two and I'm learning from them while they learn from me. So, you know, sources of strength, what puts you back on that? Giving, mentorship. These, I have like 10 different practices that I tried them again. And, you know, I knew they worked because they worked after a divorce. They worked after I got hit by a car. They worked after the death of my former husband. They worked after the suicide of what should have been my stepson. And then I gave them to 65 other people that I mentored and they worked for them, whether they were male, female, gay, straight, white, black, didn't matter. So then I thought, well, then there's something to this. There's something to this. So I got to put it in print. So I did. And I made it a kind of book that's small, easy to read. And I made it so that anyone could read it and teens like it too. And so that's what I wanted is that, you know, these are practices I learned over time, but technically I learned them from tweens and teens. So if they can implement and hold on to these things, you know, before they become an adult and have to relearn it, it would be great. I was about 2 years ago, I was asked to speak. There's a bunch of these star football players, 16, 17 year old young men, all, you know, all stars were coming together in a campaign for suicide. And they were going to do these PSA announcements on suicide and they would play throughout the month. You know, they're all stiff. They're all in there. They're all told what they're supposed to be. Each one of these kids has a ride to college and I'd come in, you know, and I told them, you know, first of all, as an auctioneer, just for fun, whenever I need to like, and let anyone be at ease. I go, you know what I do? I do this for a living. 1,000, you have it at 15, now 2, now 25, you have it at 3, now 35, you have it at 4, 4,000, you have it at 45, sold 5,000. So anytime you want to do that, or you do it with some kids, they're like, all right, cool. She almost raps. It's okay. So, you know, you do that with some teens and disarm them. But I have this group of guys and I said to them, you know, when you go to do these PSAs, if anyone can smell BS from a mile away, it's a teen, you know? Yeah. And if you ever really want to know how someone really is, just bring a couple teens around them. They'll figure it out in 2 seconds. And I said, so your messages are going to get, you know, if you're just sitting there. But I told them, you know, how many of you really had these dark places? How many in their hands started going up? And finally, I said, as young men, I'm going to tell you the truth. There's so much pressure being put on you right now, okay? And yet you're told you know nothing. Yet you're told your opinion doesn't count. And you're probably closer to the man that you want to be right now then the next 30 years of your life, where you will run around moving further away from who you are now, only to pay top dollar to get back to where you once were. You'll try therapy, you'll try groups, you'll try everything. So sit in this phase and bring out your authenticity because you know more than you think right now, even if we don't acknowledge it. And that's kind of how I feel about that. I learned the most from them. You know, it's a difficult time. So I think if they learn those processes of no reserve early on, because they kind of invent them because they don't have those same fears and those limitations that we do until they're imposed upon them. And then they work the rest of their lives trying to learn how to get back there and remove them. So it's kind of a catch 22.
Well, that's powerful. It's good advice.
Yeah, I love that book. Thank you. I'm really glad that you did write it.
Our famous question, Tisha, is, and it came from really out of the pain of the pandemic and this, where, you know, we've all been said, what advice would you give your 21-year-old self? And that's good. But we've been saying for the other side, saying, all right, I need more wisdom than that for myself right now. So we started to do this meditation and exercise of calling, what advice would your 75-year-old self give to you right now? If you really had to stop and think and look ahead, you know, years down the road, what advice do you think Tish of 75 would give to Tish today and to other people today?
Okay, I love that you asked this because I recently journaled a note to myself from my 80-year-old self.
Wow. It's very powerful. Yeah. I mean, it like catapulted us through the pandemic with a lot more happiness, joy, and prosperity than most, I think.
We added 2 foster children to our 4 blended. So we had a 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 15 and 17, as well as running a couple of companies out of our house. So this was something that he really, one day on his holy shit, what are we doing walks. And he came back home and he was like, so full of this joy. And I was like, wow, you got all that? Like, yay. I was so grateful for
that. Amazing. That's amazing. And about all those kids and all those ages, I think it's just because you want to keep restarting those 18 summers and restarting those 18 summers. I love it. I love it. I love it. You know, when I did this, the first thing I said to her is, congratulations, you are graced with getting old. It's not a gift that everyone gets. So first of all, breathe, exhale, you'll get there. Secondly, I would tell her, you know, I know that those warrior years are hard, and the pandemic offered my first ever true pause from the gerbil wheel of how do I stop working like this and doing this. And I think I would tell my younger self, you'll miss the warrior of old, but you'll look at her a lot, kind of like you did the pandemic. You know, you might think it was difficult and it seemed like just going to be the worst, most uncomfortable thing in the world. But in truth, you kind of took this pause to realize, wow, I was moving so fast. And what talents did I not actually bring to the top because I was moving that fast? And now that I've had the pause, the true question is, do I want to go back? So I think my older self would ask her and tell her, I wouldn't want to go back to where you are, but I can guarantee you, no matter what you go through from here to where I sit, you would do it 1,000 times over.
Wow.
So be gentle with yourself. Be kind to yourself. Don't stop. Don't give up. Have grace. Have patience for those around you, but most importantly, for you, because you do it. You do it. And you would do it again and again and again. Yet I wouldn't go back if you paid me, but you would do it 5,000 more times to get to where I am. So I think that would be what I would tell her. So
and I love that you shared that, because it's something that I've shared with you so many times, where he feels, you know, that feeling of, gosh, I wish I could have met you. So, oh, I wish I could have helped. So I wish, you know, that this, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Like going through that to get here, all day long.
Yeah.
You know, like,
exactly. But at the same time, I feel like if it was Groundhog Day and I wasn't going to know, I would keep doing it. And just like in the movie, for lack of a better term, just trying to, it's you versus you. You're not really competing with anyone but yourself. So, you know, these adversities, these things that come are not really blows. They're more opportunities for you versus you, you know? So let's see if you can get a better swing in the ring this time, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom.
Such a pleasure. Such a pleasure.
Where can we find the book? Where can people contact?
So the book, believe it or not, in this modern day world, a first-time author got a huge publishing deal. So it's everywhere. It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. Awesome. Pretty much anywhere you could buy a book, it's there. I got a deal with Sound Wisdom Publishing, which is a huge honor for me because I published a lot of my favorite authors. So, yep, it's called No Reserve, and you can get it pretty much anywhere you can buy a book. And I did an audio book, which was really fun because it's very rare that they let first-time authors do their own audio. So I did my own audio and get that on Audible, all the rest of it. So appreciate that plug. And, you know, even if it helps one person, it was worth it.
Good.
And we'll make sure. How about your social medias?
So I'm really going to be honest. Like, you can find me, you know, I have a website, LetitiaFry.com. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at TheLetitiaFry. But I'll be honest, I'm addicted to Instagram. I'm addicted to the gram. So really at Letitia_Fry. Instagram is just, I feel like it's, once you get on Instagram, you feel like you're scrapbooking with your grandparents when you get back on Facebook. And, you know, so Instagram's really my best. And here's the one thing I always tell everyone, because I have a lot of followers from different countries and different teens and whatnot. I answer, it's me. As long as you're not being rude or, you know, disrespectful, I'll answer you. It's me all the time. So send a message, DM me, I'll answer you back.
Beautiful. Thank you again for sharing with our tribe. It was
my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you so much. And keep up those 18 summers.